Call to worship. Oh, sing a new song to the eternal. Shout praise, all earth, break into music and song. Praise the eternal with lyre and song. Let the sea and all within it thunder praise. The world and its inhabitants, let rivers clap their hands. Let mountains sing in chorus. Oh, sing a new song to the eternal. Psalm 98. Today, our chalice will be lit by James. Please join me in reciting these words. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. Thank you, James. Our opening hymn today will be 151 from the Gray Hymnal, I Wish I Knew How. Please stand as you are willing and able.
I'd like to invite the new worship associates forward briefly to stand in front of the pulpit here. As you are maybe aware, this past month we started our new worship associate program. We initially had six. One of the members, Sayer Johnson, had to back out of this commitment, so we are actually seeking one more worship associate. So if you're interested, let me know. These five folks have committed and have completed their orientation through about 2 hours of training and an hour of conversation. And so I want to congratulate Dee Evans, Sabrina Trupia, Yomi Kinder, Joy Trout, and Marie Johnson. Mary Johnson. Huh? Joy Heft. Did I say Trout? Ah, Joy Heft. You can pay me back later. It's all good. And so at this time, I invite everyone to repeat after me in the pews. We offer to you, our presence, our support, our compassionate feedback. Very important. And to the worship associates, I invite you to repeat after me. We commit to serve you with love and respect, and offer our gratitude for the trust that you place in us. May it be so. And congratulations to these five folks. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me round, turn me round. Turn me round, ain't gonna let nobody turn me round. I'm gonna keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching up to freedom land. The protesters sang and chanted on the 50-mile march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. They began their march with that hymn. The black people of Selma had tried to march earlier in the month to demonstrate for African-American voting rights and in remembrance of a young black man, Jimmy Lee Jackson, who had been killed a few weeks before during another peaceful protest. However, the earlier protests had been called off when the marchers were met by police officers who beat them and imprisoned many. Now the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was leading a new march to the state capitol in protest. And marchers planned to let nothing stop them. Their numbers had grown past 20,000, well more than the total number of people who lived in Selma itself. Many people had seen televised the footage of Bloody Sunday. When the first march was brutally attacked, many had heard the call from Reverend King for lovers of justice to come to Selma and join in the march. One who saw and heard was a white woman from Detroit, Michigan, Viola Liuzzo. Now she was in Selma to support the cause of civil rights, and her car was in Selma too, being used to pick up people from the airport and drop them off at various points in the march. After the march, Viola helped drive supporters to the airport and bus train stations for their journey home. But Viola herself did not go home. Home for Viola was Detroit, but it had once been Pennsylvania where she was born, and then Tennessee, and then Georgia. Her family had moved to where her father and mother could find work, which wasn't easy. Viola's family had struggled. Yet, as hard a time as her family had had wherever they went, Viola could see that black people had a much harder time. Viola asked herself why some people had so much wealth and others so little. She wondered what the color of a person's skin had to do with whether they would be a hard worker or a good student. And when her family moved to Michigan, she thought things would be better. After all, segregation by skin color happened in the southern states, and Michigan was in the north. However, in Michigan, Viola encountered segregation in a different form than she had ever seen. She saw that even when segregation was not enforced by law, white people and black people lived in two different worlds. And she wondered why some people thought it impossible that white people and black people could be friends at all. All that thinking helped Viola form firm opinions about what is right and what is wrong and what is fair. All that thinking, yeah. And once she made her mind up, nobody was going to turn her around. So she worked for economic justice and for better educational system in Detroit. She worked for the civil rights with the NAACP, the National Association of Colored People, alongside her black friends. And when she did not see her beliefs and values reflected in the Catholic Church she attended, she left and joined the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Detroit. When Viola heard Reverend King's call to Selma to bear witness to injustice and march on behalf of voting rights for all, she let nothing stop her from doing what she believed she had to do. Go to Selma and support the march. Viola had 5 children, had many responsibilities at home, and even so, once she made her mind to go, she called her husband and told him her plans, and he was worried. Viola, it might be dangerous. I know, she replied. Viola, you might get killed. I know, she answered. But everyone else could try to talk her out of it. Viola was in her station wagon and heading to Alabama. She held hands with brothers and sisters and siblings and crossed the bridge and marched. And she offered her car to be used as needed. And late one night, Viola and a young African-American man drove some marchers home in Viola's car. Another car filled with men from the Ku Klux Klan pulled up alongside Viola's car on a lonely stretch of road. The men shot Viola and killed her because she was a white woman trying to help black people claim their civil rights. Viola's murder outraged many people. It followed the murder of Reverend James Reeb and the murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson and added to the public pressure on legislatures in Washington, D.C. Congress responded to that pressure and passed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, 50 years ago. And Viola's dedication to her values and her sacrifice brought all of us a little bit closer to freedom. Further, the American Civil Rights Movement has inspired oppressed people all over the world. Viola Liuzzo is the only white woman honored on the Civil Rights Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. A memorial plaque honoring Viola Liuzzo, Jimmie Lee Jackson, and James Reeb hangs at the national offices of the Unitarian Universalist Association in Boston, Massachusetts. Today, we celebrate and remember the life of Viola Liuzzo. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching up to freedom land.
We invite the children to go down to the religious education studies. And we sing them out. You to move to the microphone and share briefly any gratitudes or celebrations you bring with you to church this morning. There will be a time for concerns and sorrows in a few minutes.
My name is Rick Russo. I am Andrew Russo's brother and Suganya Russo's brother-in-law. And Guy has played at that piano. He's doing well at Vanderbilt. I am going to eat corned beef and cabbage on St. Patrick's Day coming up at 5:30. That's when I'm going to start. Thank you all for making me feel welcome here today. I am so happy to be here.
I now invite you to move to the microphone and share briefly any sorrows and concerns you bring with you to church this morning.
So I mentioned a few weeks ago, my Aunt Vicky, several years ago, beat mouth cancer. And about 6 months ago, they realized that it had returned and spread to several organs in her body. She is now at her sister's home. Hospice is caring for her, and she's probably going to be transitioning soon. So if you would think of Vicky, I'd appreciate it.
Sherry Huber, who's my girlfriend's mother, passed away last Sunday. That's why I wasn't here. Our funeral was on Thursday. She had been battling cancer for several years and was under hospice care and passed away. Thank you.
I also have a concern and a sorrow. Last night I was at a dinner party and a new friend that I had just met went to the bathroom and had a stroke. And she is in surgery as we speak. So if you could please put out good thoughts to her. She's a wonderful woman for the 15 minutes I got to meet her before she had her problems. So I would appreciate that. May the gratitude and celebration among us this day become a blessing to all. And may the concerns and sorrows of each be carried in all of our hearts. A burden shared becomes a load lightened.
I invite you now into a time of meditation, contemplation, or prayer, as is your own personal spiritual practice. And I invite you to become aware of the space around you and to take in a slow, deep breath in and out. Now one more time so your neighbor can hear you, in and out. On this day, we offer our gratitude and celebration for friends and family here with us today, for the support of community and the love of friends and strangers, the abundance of this community that has so much to give to all new and long time. May we continue to lift up all those who need lifting and support, particularly those who are experiencing times of sickness and uncertainty. We offer blessings for all who are receiving surgery at this time, who are finding a sudden change in their lives, unexpected and unwanted, and for all those who care and support for them. May they have blessings of healing and wholeness in their lives. For those living with illness and who are dying, those living with, dying with, and who have died of cancer, an illness that plagues so many in our world. May we find presence of spirit to be with our grief, to understand grief as a form of love, a sign that those we grieve matter in our lives. May we give space to those who need it and give closeness to those who want it in these times of struggle. I offer you these meditation words. Do not think we are finished. Oh no, we will never be finished, never just done until the light of justice is lit behind every eye. Do not think we will be silent.
No, there will not be silence until the world has sung the names of the dead with full throats, and still we will sing on. Do not think fear is the end of us. Oh, you are broken in mind and heart if you even imagine that our fear for our lives is the end of this story. We are braver than you have ever conceived, and you will not be the end of us. We have come back to take the world that is the inheritance of better children, better lovers, better days. There will be love again, but justice is our demand now. You will not take us down. We are endless, firelit, determined, and we are coming for you. On this, the anniversary of Bloody Sunday, we offer our blessings and our vigilance, our courage and our compassion to all who are walking in Selma and from Selma to Montgomery today and this week. For the hundreds of Unitarian Universalists who have gathered there to remember our fallen siblings. And for all who commit and recommit themselves to justice, for as much as we have done, we still have more to do. May we be ever vigilant and ever courageous. I invite you now into a time of silent contemplation, prayer, or meditation. You to take a deep breath in and out and in and out. Amen and blessed be. Please join in singing Spirit of Life, hymn number 123.
When I heard the service today was on the Selma marches, I realized I didn't know very much about them. So I did some research. One of the big sparks of the protests was literacy tests, so I looked it up. In Part A, the applicant was given a selection of the Alabama Constitution to read aloud. The register chose from a large, loose-leaf binder. Some selections were easier than others. If white applicants were tested at all, they generally got the easier ones. The register would make sure to give the black applicants the hardest ones, filled with legalese and long, convoluted sentences. An example of one of the white selections: that no person shall be imprisoned for debt. An example of the black, one of the black selections: the income arising from the 16th Protection Trust Fund, the Surplus Revenue Fund, until it is called for by the U.S. government, and the funds enumerated in sections 257 and 258 of this Constitution, together with a special annual tax of 30 cents on each $100 of taxable property in the state, which the legislature shall levy, shall be applied to the support and maintenance of the public school. Let me stop there because it continues. It's one big long sentence and it's 10 typed lines. The registrar would then mark any words that in their opinion were mispronounced. In some counties, the applicant would then have to interpret the registrar's selection. After this, the applicant would then have to copy from a sheet or write from dictation the selection spoken by the registrar. Whites usually were allowed to copy. Blacks had to take dictation. The registrar would then judge the applicant literate or illiterate, and their judgment was final and could not be appealed. Parts B and C were a set of two sets of four written questions. Special teachers were brought into the areas to help black applicants pass these citizen tests. 1965. High school educations were just becoming standard. Most people worked with an eighth grade education, if even that much. Take a minute to think how demoralizing and nerve-wracking such a test would be. We each receive from this church the opportunity to explore meaning, purpose, and value in our lives. How does the money you give reflect what you receive? As you give to our plate this morning, you are invited to consider how your spiritual life, the life of meaning and value and purpose, are enhanced through your giving. This morning's offering will be greatly received. May it be joyfully given.
To the work of the church, which is weaving a tapestry of love we call community, we dedicate ourselves and these our offerings.
In the early hours of Monday, March 8th, 1965, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. dispatched a telegraph that read, "In the vicious maltreatment of defenseless citizens of Selma, where old women and young children are gassed and clubbed at random, we have witnessed an eruption of the disease of racism which seeks to destroy all of America. No American is without responsibility. All are involved in the sorrow that rises from Selma to contaminate every crevice of our national life. The people of Selma will struggle on for the soul of the nation, but it is fitting that all America help to bear the burden. I call, therefore, on the clergy of all faiths, representative of every part of the country, to join me for a minister's march to Montgomery on Tuesday morning, March 9th. In this way, all America will testify to the fact that the struggle in Selma is for the survival of democracy everywhere in our land.
That call for clergy from across the country, forever changed the way our country formed and the way this denomination formed. The events of Bloody Sunday and the events leading up to Bloody Sunday had been horrible. And the fact that it was televised changed the entire conversation. People had been beaten before. Jimmie Lee Jackson had been killed just a week before. But none of that had been televised, and very little of that had been in the news. On Bloody Sunday, reporters watched and videotaped and reported the violence of an out-of-control sheriff trying to make a point. Tear gas, wounds, people running for their lives, women and children. And when that call came out at 4 a.m. the next Monday, the next morning, immediately ministers and lay leaders began to plan their journey to Selma. Within the first 48 hours from that call, 45 ministers and 15 lay leaders were in Selma from as far away as Seattle, Berkeley, Boston, Florida, Michigan, and Canada. Already on planes that day were ministers from England and lay leaders from India, and collections were being taken in Transylvania and the world around. Our denomination replied and responded immediately and with force, and were forever transformed and changed. Before I get too far into our story, I want to tell you a little bit about what Montgomery and Selma and the world of Alabama is like today. I think we've heard the stories. We know a lot about what's going on in the history of the South. But how does the South continue to live on with it today? I served a congregation in Montgomery, Alabama for 2 years before I came here. And there were a number of things that surprised me. Perhaps one of the most shocking things that I first saw was this image. This is the Great Seal of the City of Montgomery, and on the outside it reads, or in the center circle it reads, Birthplace of the Civil Rights Movement. And on the star in the middle it reads, Cradle of the Confederacy. And if that is not a definition of what the world is like in Alabama at this time, particularly in Selma and Montgomery, I don't think anything is. Because this is a place that is trying to live with a dual history. It is not shying away from its civil rights history. And in many ways, Selma, Montgomery, Tuskegee, Birmingham, they are proud of the work that they have done, and as well they should be. They continue to do amazing work to this day. That consent decree that Ferguson is expected to sign in the coming weeks, Montgomery and Selma and Birmingham and places in Mississippi did that work 50 years ago. And yet so many places have yet to do it today. The reason why the birthplace of the civil rights movement is placed there so proudly is because some of the most amazing activists of our times, most amazing work of our world was done in Alabama and in Mississippi and in Georgia and in Arkansas and Louisiana. And that center bit, the star with the cradle of the Confederacy, well, that comes from another star. So if you go to the next slide, this is on the front steps of the Capitol in Montgomery, Alabama. It is a little star that was placed there in honor of Jefferson Davis. Anybody know who Jefferson Davis is? First president of the, and only president, happily, of the Confederacy. In fact, this star was so beloved that when John Kennedy himself came to visit Montgomery, Alabama, they placed a barrier around it to make sure that he would not spoil this consecrated and holy and sacred place with his liberalism. The Star of David is a symbol of the Daughters of the Confederacy. And this star was a gift from the Daughters of the Confederacy in honor of Jefferson Davis. The picture you see here is at a protest for voting rights for African Americans that happened last spring. As new voting laws make it more and more difficult for people of color and people of minority communities to vote because they don't have the requisite ID. And so we're reminded, as much work as has been done, there is still more to do. The next slide, we can see a bit of the history of Montgomery and of the South. Montgomery, Alabama was the center of the domestic slave trade. Once slave transportation was made illegal and it was not possible to import slaves from Africa anymore, the biggest trade was in domestic slaves that were already here. And most of them were sold out of Montgomery. And in fact, until the past 20 years, the majority of people living in Montgomery, Alabama were black. When you look at this picture, you see the history of the city and of the state. Where that water fountain is where they used to sell slaves. That was the selling block until recent history. On the right corner, that very first store used to be the telegraph office. And that is where Robert E. Lee received a telegraph, or it was Jefferson Davis sent the telegraph to Robert E. Lee to start the Civil War. And in the left, two stores in, is where Rosa Parks worked and was where she came from to get on that bus, where she refused to get up. And this street is called Dexter Avenue. And so as you might imagine, that big spire on the right is Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, where Martin Luther King preached many, many times during the Montgomery bus boycott. And at the very end, you can see the little white dome. That is the Congress, the building where that Star of David sits. All of that history in one picture. All of that history in one place. And Selma is no different. You can walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, Edmund Pettus being a Ku Klux Klan member, as well as the founder of many things. You can visit the stores, and very little has changed. It looks very much now as it did 50 years ago. And you can see signs supporting the civil rights movement, and you see signs celebrating Confederate leaders. A world mired in history. And yet the power of that history is that they don't hide it. I think we could learn a lot from our southern neighbors as northerners and not hide our history. What would it mean to have a monument to the riots in East St. Louis? What it would mean to have a monument to the white flight supported by the home ownership programs? In the history of the modern day in Montgomery, leads to some fascinating paradoxes. If you go to the next slide, this sign greets you as you're walking out of the electricity office in Montgomery, and it is the site of the first and only White House of the Confederacy. And if you go to the next slide, that's where the White House used to be. It is now a skate park, which I think is wonderful. What they did was they picked up the White House and they moved it, and it's still there and it's a museum. But I do hope that Jefferson Davis is rolling in his grave as he recognizes that skateboarders and tweakers and everybody and their mother is probably hanging out on his old place. The next slide is from Jefferson Davis Highway. This marker is on the property of the first the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Montgomery and cannot be moved because it is a historic marker. The street has long since been changed to Atlanta Highway, but to most of the locals, it's still Jefferson Davis Highway. And just a few blocks from the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Montgomery is the Robert E. Lee High School, which is 95% African American. A lot has changed, and so one has to ask, how do you get such a dichotomous history in such a place? And some of that is obvious. In the summer of 64, much effort had been placed in trying to create voting rights, and at the end of 64, Martin Luther King Jr. and the members of SCLC had gone to determine, was Selma a ripe place for moving the civil rights movement forward? How many of you have seen the movie Selma now? Really? I really encourage you to see it. It is very well done. And James Reeb and Viola Liuzzo are in it. There's definitely a nod to Unitarian Universalists in that film. But they do show that when he arrived, Martin Luther King Jr. arrived in town, he was punched by a white person for trying to get a hotel room in Selma. And this told them that because that level of violence was acceptable and the tension was so palpable, that this would be a place where they could affect change. Because what people pay attention to is violence, not peacefulness. In that summer of 64, just before all of this happened, three lay volunteers who were Unitarian Universalists named James Chaney, Mickey Schwerna, and Andy Goodman disappeared while trying to help people vote in Mississippi. And their bodies were found 6 weeks later. Already white folks were being killed and disappeared in the Deep South. But these were isolated incidences and they were often unheard of. There were already ministers of the Unitarian Universalist Association in Selma. One of those was Gordon Gibson. He left for Selma the day after his ordination, and he said on the day of his ordination he received lots of advice, but the one that stuck with him was from a Reverend Olson, who said, "Don't go to Selma unless it's more important to you to go than to come back." Knowing for certain that there was a good chance you might not return. I have to say, Gordon's still there. I love him. He's a great guy. He is feisty and in his 80s and tells stories like you wouldn't believe. And he continues to fight for voting rights in the South to this day. And actually, during the time in which Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed, Gordon Gibson and another one of his colleagues were in the Selma jail, had been arrested for marching on the sidewalks without permission. Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed in Marion, which is just a little ways from Selma, Alabama. He and his parents had been running because they had been at a march and the police had started to attack. And they ran into a restaurant to try and get away, and the state police, the state troopers, found them and started beating on his parents. In an effort to get them to stop beating on his elderly parents, one state trooper shot him twice in the chest and left him to die. That barely made the news. That was February 26th, 1965. And so it was just 11 days later, on March 7th, 1965, that a group of African Americans from SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and from SCLC marched across Edmund Pettus Bridge. with the intention of marching to Montgomery, Alabama, some 50 miles away. And to give you a sense of how far 50 miles is, if you march from Wentzville, Missouri, to Greenville, Illinois, that's 50 miles. No small march that. Before they could even get across the bridge, they were beaten, they were gassed, many were injured severely, and as I mentioned, it was all caught on tape. And so that next morning, the call for ministers went out, and as I said, 45 within 48 hours, 60 within 2 days, and that was 10% of the Unitarian Universalist ministry, as well as 30 plus lay leaders and many more on their way. In those first 48 hours, there were 80 marches in cities across the world. And by March 9th, they were ready to march again with more than 10,000 people in the city of Selma. It is at this time that Orloff Miller, Clark Olson, and James Reeb arrived. They were there on that first day. And on that night, the first night after the call of being in Selma, they had been in Selma for just a few hours, not very long at all, and were eating at a local restaurant that was integrated. And as they walked back to the local Baptist church where things were being organized, a group of white men surrounded them and beat them with clubs. Clark Olson and Orloff Miller are still alive today, and both recount that they can still hear clearly in their minds the loud crack of the billy club against Jim Reeb's head. They were all beaten, but not all of them had been given the information on what to do in the event of being beaten, and so not all of them protected themselves appropriately. It took a long time to get James Reeb to the hospital in Birmingham, Alabama, because the ambulance broke down. Its tire went flat, it didn't have a siren, and they weren't sure if this was intentional or not, but they waited for a second ambulance and realized they couldn't keep traveling because there were cars driving by, checking on them and clearly waiting for a moment to attack. So they had to wait for somebody from the organizing committees to get a car that had a radio in it because the radio wasn't working in the ambulance to get them to Birmingham safely. They asked for an escort. The police refused. In what should have taken 2.5 to 3 hours to get Jim Reeb to the Birmingham hospital, it took them the entire night. And they were not in time. Despite calling the best neurosurgeon in the state of Alabama, he died 2 days later on March 11th. The decision of his wife, Marie, to pull the plug because she didn't think that the life-saving measures were helping him anymore. Within those next few days, there were so many memorial services. What is interesting is the violence did not end. That Saturday after he died, Unitarian Universalist Reverend Albert D'Orlando's home was firebombed in New Orleans as he was writing a eulogy for Jim Reeb. And the next day, his congregation was bombed. Violence continued well on after Bloody Sunday, and people kept showing up because that's what we do. That's what we do. But this was a game changer for Unitarian Universalism. This is not what we had always done. We often spoke of equality, but we hadn't quite understood how to realize it. And World War II changed that. We became a more interfaith denomination because of World War II, and we became more open to diversity because of World War II. If we were going to stand against Nazism, then we had to stand against racial segregation. And we had to say yes to people who did not typically attend our congregations. In 1963, a survey of all the denominations' congregations showed that only 12 congregations had 5 or more African Americans attending. And of those, all of them were in the West, except for one. We still had a lot of work to do. The death of Jim Reeb and the death of Viola Luzzo changed that because we said, these are our people. And we started to show up in droves, and we started to say no more in our communities. And so we remember. If we go to the next slide. That is the Edmund Pettus Bridge as it stands today, and I would like to thank Mary Johnson for this photo, which she took just a couple of weeks ago, in fact. It looks very much today as it did 50 years ago, down to the sign. And the next slide. And this is Reverend Jim Reeb. Next. So today we remember the people who gave their lives, who were martyred, so that people may be able to vote, so they may live into one of our most important values. Our fifth principle is Unitarian Universalist, the right of the democratic process, the right to be heard, to have all voices present. Each of those pictures that you see on the wall represents someone who was killed in the civil rights movement around voting rights. Next. When you go to the Civil Rights Memorial in downtown Montgomery, you have the opportunity of looking around these rooms and seeing these places. You also have the opportunity of seeing a documentary video that tells the stories of various civil rights leaders, including that of Viola Luzzo. She had been a Unitarian Universalist for all of a year when she died. Can you imagine? She was very little known. In fact, her memorial service occurred without any Unitarian Universalist present, because her husband wished she had stayed Catholic. Some of us know that story. Next slide. Today, there is a marker on Highway 80 that shows where she died. People drive down that highway every day, back and forth, because the Montgomery Airport is there. Montgomery houses one of our major Air Force bases and officer training schools. And so people drive by this site on a regular basis. It's worth noting that the military has been a liberalizing force in Montgomery and in Selma. Hard to imagine for some, but it is true. And the next slide. So if you go into downtown Montgomery, you can see this table. It has water that flows off, and it shows all the people who were martyred for the Voting Rights Act, including Viola and Jim Reeb. Their lives have shaped us in unimaginable ways. Unitarian Universalism from that day onward became an institution, a denomination of action and of saying yes to people of community. The people who went to the civil rights marches in Selma in 1965, many of them became the leaders of change in Unitarian Universalism thereafter. From the Black Empowerment Movement that happened just 2 years later, to the work of LGBT equality, which happened just a few years later. In fact, Eugene Navias and Jim Stoll, two of the forerunners of marriage equality and LGBT equality in our churches, were at those marches that very year. It wasn't all easy, though. One of our gay ministers was told that if he went to the march, he could just take his boyfriend with him and never return to that church because they would not support him. Many ministers and lay leaders were told that if they went to the marches that summer, they would not be welcome anymore. And just as many churches ponied up money to send members. In fact, Clark Olson was a member, or was the minister at the UU Fellowship in Berkeley, California, could not afford to go, heard the call, and tried to figure out how, and as soon as he got to his office that morning, two members had said, "We will pay for you to go." We have made it possible, and at the same time, we have been our own hindrance in making things possible. Just like that seal in Montgomery. Cradle of the Confederacy. Birthplace of the Civil Rights Movement. We are paradoxical creatures, we human beings. And yet, we continue to move forward. We continue to work towards justice. We continue to have that arc that bend towards justice, as Theodore Parker put it, and Dr. King quoted later. It's worth noting that this changed our lives and the lives of so many. That very next year, Dr. Martin Luther King came to the Ware Lecture at our General Assembly and spoke one of the best speeches I've ever heard him give. And we started to change. We made Eyes on the Prize possible. We created About Your Sexuality. And women started to say, we need a place at the table. We worked with vigilance, with patience and hope for a world transformed by our care, for a vision of the future of what's possible. And we continue to do so today. So as we listen about Ferguson, as we listen about all of the things going on in our world, as we continue to be at the forefront of LGBT equality in our denomination, may we as a congregation and as people in these pews remember who helped make it possible for us to do these things. May it be so. I invite you to rise as your spirits and bodies allow and join in singing the African American anthem, Lift Every Voice. Face across the aisles towards one another. Smile at each other. This is our sacred community where change becomes possible, where we heal the wounds created by difference and cruelty. We close with these words from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King at the General Assembly Ware Lecture in 1966. The idea whose time has come today is the idea of freedom and human dignity. And so all over the world, we see something of freedom explosion. And this reveals to us that we are in the midst of revolutionary times. An older order is passing away and a new order is coming into being. The role of the church is to broaden horizons, to challenge the status quo, and to question and break mores. The church has a major role to play in this period of social change. It must remain awake through this revolution. So may we stay awake together. May it be so.